Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Exodus again. We're going to be in the golden calf experience, and I hope you'll turn with me to Exodus 32. I have a commentary by Rashi, who is a Middle Ages Jewish exegete, and he really adds some insight here as far as the way the Jews look at this. They're really nervous about Aaron having such duplicity in this account, so they really interpret this as Aaron trying to help Moses. I think it's going to be interesting to you to hear the side of the rabbis. But I hope you'll get your Bible and turn to Exodus 32. It's a pivotal account of the apostasy of Israel, Moses' intercessory prayer, and God's forgiveness, but the consequences of their act lingers on. It's a very interesting passage because of all the Old Testament point of view it pulls in. So let's look at verse 1 of Exodus 32. Now when the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, remember what happened is God came down on Mount Sinai with smoke and fire, and God's voice spoke like a trumpet, and it scared the hound out of the people. They said, whoa, we don't want to hear God talk anymore. Moses, you go up and talk to him. So Moses has gone up on the mountain. From Exodus 25:18, we know that it was 40 days ago that he went up there. They thought he was dead. They didn't know what to think. 40 days. Now, in the Bible, 40 days does not seem to be 40 24-hour days, but a long period of indefinite time. Just think of the number of times in the Bible that number 40 is used. And, of course, the ancient people weren't as calendar-oriented as we are. So, but a long time, Moses has been up there, and they grew very impatient. So here's what they did. And the people assembled about Aaron and said to him, "Come, make for us a God who will go before us." Now look at your Bible. Do you have a God, little g, or do you have gods, plural? Now the word here is Elohim, and is usually translated capital G, God, in most parts of the Old Testament. But here it has a plural verb, and so many have said it has to be gods. Sometimes the angels are called the Elohim, but usually it refers for the general designation for Yahweh, okay, the one God. It's a universal kind of thing. The rabbis say it's the plural of majesty. Now, I personally think that it is the little g God, even though it's plural. There's plurals everywhere in Hebrew that we don't think should be plural. And the reason I think it is, I don't think that these people broke the first commandment about having any other gods. I think they broke the second commandment about making a graven image. I think what Aaron's going to make is a representation of God, Yahweh. I get that from the same chapter, verses 4 and 5, especially the last part of 5 where it says, "Tomorrow shall be a feast to the Lord." So as far as Aaron was concerned, the young bull symbolized the covenant God of Israel. Now, notice where it says, "The man who brought us up from the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him." Well, isn't that a strange understanding of what's happened? They think Moses has delivered them, when in reality it was God that delivered them. These people are still theologically naive, and they're still a group of slaves who have just been delivered. And so their theology and understanding is way lacking. But to put it on Moses was to totally miss the focus of all the plagues of the Exodus. God was judging those Egyptian gods and trying to prove that he was the Lord. And they didn't even realize. They said, well, Moses is the guy who's done this. Now, notice what it says in verse 2. "And Aaron said to them, 'Tear off the gold rings which are in your ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters, and bring them to me.'" Now, the gold rings seem to be the gifts that the Egyptians gave them when they left, Exodus 12:36. Now, it seems rather unusual here that what was meant to be a blessing, these gold rings, came to be a curse. Now, later on, I don't know how many of these gold rings they used in the making of this calf, but they apparently still had more because they brought these same gold jewelry to the tabernacle later, or more gold jewelry, to make the tabernacle. Now, when it says, "in your ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters," seems to imply that men wore earrings. Wouldn't that be something if modern hippies were just reflecting an ancient Hebrew tradition? There are several other scriptures that seem to imply this idea that even men wore jewelry and ornaments. If you go back to Genesis 35:4, Exodus 11:2, and Exodus 33:5-6, after this, a deal, men quit wearing jewelry, and so did women. So, That's an interesting thought. Now, in verse 3, it mentions, "Then all the people tore off the gold rings which were in their ears and brought them to Aaron. And he took this from their hand and formed it with it a graving tool and made it into a molten calf." Now, the rabbis say Aaron took it and formed it himself so that the people would not have the blame for this, that he alone would have the blame. And this is just one set of interpretations through here the rabbis get. They try to say Aaron knew it was a sin, and he didn't know how to stop it. He was afraid they would kill him if he didn't, so he just took all the blame on himself. Nice motive, just doesn't fit the context. And then the last part of this verse where it says, "This is your God," that's the same word, Elohim, "O Israel, who brought you up from the land of Egypt." Now, the rabbis say that a mixed group came out of Egypt, Egyptians and Israelites. And these Egyptians are saying this because it would be unusual for Hebrews to call themselves, "O Israel." So they make this the minority of Egyptians leading the Israelites back into idolatry. Now, when it says, "Now Aaron saw this, he built an altar before it and made proclamation and said, 'Tomorrow shall be a feast to the Lord.'" Now again, the rabbis say Aaron is trying to delay them, trying to put them off a while, to give Moses a chance to come back. He's saying the reason he built the altar is because he took a lot more time and tried to, you know, delay them. And the reason he said tomorrow we'll have a feast is to put them off one more day, hoping that Moses would make it down from the mountain. Now, the context doesn't seem to back that up, but that's the rabbinical understanding of this. Now, when it continues, "So the next day they rose early and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings, and the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play." Now, this word "to play" is used in Genesis 26:8 in a sexual connotation. So what it seems we have here is a sexual orgy, really. It is in line with the fertility cults of Canaan. Now, the young bull, really it shouldn't be calf, it should be young bull. The young bull was a symbol of fertility and virileness and strength and power for all the ancient Near East in this time. But whether it be Baal, or there's even down in Egypt, one of the gods are worshipped as a bull calf, and over in Assyria, all over this area, the bull was a symbol. Now, it seems, because it says a feast to Yahweh, that it's a symbol of God here. Matter of fact, a little later on, when they make the sea or the laver in the temple, it's sitting on four oxen facing east direction. And even the cherubim, who have four faces, one of an eagle, one of a man, one of an ox. See? So this ox thing is caught up in representative symbolism even within Israel. And that's what it seems to be. So I think the fertility aspect of this is caught up in that young bull. Now it says, "Then the Lord spoke to Moses, 'Go down at once, for your people whom you brought up from the land of Egypt have corrupted themselves.'" Even God doesn't want to take the blame. He's saying, it's your people, Moses. You brought them out and they've corrupted themselves. Now Moses is going to say, whoa, it's not my fault. They're not my people. They're your people. Then in verse 11, he switches it back to thy people. But the word corrupted is the same word that's used for the people in the days of Noah. So, notice in verse 8, "They have quickly turned aside from the way which I commanded them." Now, this deal about turned aside, remember the two Hebrew words, righteous means a straight edge or a straight path, you know, something straight. Crookedness or wickedness means to deviate from that thing. So turn aside is another Hebrew word to deviate from the standard, which is God and His will. "And they have made for themselves a molten calf and have worshipped it and have sacrificed to it and said, 'This is your God, O Israel, who brought you up in the land of Egypt.'" So God says, look, not only have they made an idol, but they've worshipped it and sacrificed to it and stuck my name on it. Now, verse 9. "The Lord said to Moses, 'I have seen this people. Behold, they are an obstinate people.'" Now, the word there in Hebrew is stiff-necked. It is a word that is used for domestic animals that do not respond to the bridle or the rope or the yoke. They will not do what the master wants them to, and that's the picture of Israel. In the book of Deuteronomy, God says He picked Israel because they were so stiff-necked. God's grace is seen more sharply in contrast to a stiff-necked people. Now, it also says, "And now then, let me alone, and my anger may burn against them, and I will destroy them, and I will make you a great nation." Now, the rabbis say when God says, "Let me alone," He is giving Moses a clue that if Moses will pray for them, God will listen to Moses. I don't know how much to put in that. When it says, I'll make you a great nation, I don't think God was really so much changing his covenant promise to Abraham. I think he was testing Moses about Moses' heart and attitude and loyalty. And Moses passed the test with flying colors, I want to tell you. Now he says, then Moses entreated the Lord his God and said, O Lord, why does thine anger burn against thy people? See how he switched it back? Not mine, and they're yours. Look at verse 12. Why should the Egyptians speak with evil intent? He brought them out to kill them. Now Moses is going to do several arguments why God shouldn't kill them. Number one, they're his people. Number two, if you kill them, the Egyptians are going to misunderstand and impugn your name. And then down a little bit later in verse 13, it's going to say, remember your covenant promise to Abraham. Genesis 12, Genesis 15. You're going to bless all the world through them. You're going to give them the land. He's saying, look, God, hang in there. Remember what you promised. Then verse 14. So the Lord changed his mind. The word repented is the word here. Does it bother you the Lord repented or changed his mind? This is an anthropomorphic phrase speaking about God as if he was a man. I think the limit here is that God has always limited his actions to man's response, whether it be in salvation or many other things. Now, the overarching plan of God cannot be affected, but individual lives and relationships are affected by man's response to God. And so I think God is not only working with Moses to test him, but he is seeing that Israel had to respond by faith to participate in the plan and purpose of God. And so I think that's what it is. Now, verse 15, and Moses turned and went down from the mountain with the two tablets of the testimony in his hand, tablets which were written on both sides. Now, we know from archaeology that it is very unusual, extremely rare, for tablets in this day and time, because that's the only writing instrument there was, clay tablets, usually in cuneiform writing, to be written on both sides. Now, Rashi, the Middle Age commentator, says that what it means here is that when God wrote these words in the stone, the words, the letters, burned clear through the rock. And so you could see the backside, although it looked backwards to you. And that's what he thinks it means here. Now, it says in verse 16, that, and the tablets were God's work, and the writing was God's writing engraved in the tablets. This is the Bible's way of saying the origin and the means of the Ten Commandments, or the Ten Words, are totally of God, have nothing to do with Moses. It's not Moses' background, Moses' genius, anything. It is God's origination and not man's. The reason it's similar to the Code of Hammurabi is because God always deals with man in his cultural context. He gives man what he can understand and how far he's come. And I think he's doing that with Moses. Now, verse 17. Now, when Joshua heard, apparently Joshua had not been a part of this. Now, whether Caleb was or not, we don't know. But Joshua was somewhere between Mount Sinai and the camp. Now, whether he was up on the mountain is not certain. He probably wasn't, because you know the mountain was holy. Anything that touched the mountain had to be killed. So probably Joshua was waiting somewhere at the foot of the mountain, between the mountain and the camp, waiting for Moses, okay? Now, verse 19, nowhere it mentions Moses threw the tablets from his hands and shattered them at the foot of the mountain. There's two symbolic things here. He is, in essence, breaking the covenant, because the people of Israel had broken the covenant. Now, when it says the two tablets, there's much discussion about if the two aspects of the Ten Commandments, one was on one side and one was on the other. It seems the Ten Commandments breaks into two halves, man's relationship to God and man's relationship to man. And whether that's actual or just a modern way of looking at it, I'm not really sure. In verse 20, and he took the calf which they had made and burned it with fire and ground it into powder and scattered it over the surface of the water and made the sons of Israel drink of it. Now, grinding it into powder seems to be a way of dealing with idols. You might want to see 2 Kings 23:15. Making them drink it seems to reflect the Numbers 5, 18 through 22 passage about the test for a wife's unfaithfulness. She had to drink this concoction. If she was guilty, it would kill her. If she was not, she wouldn't be harmed. It seems like a psychological technique. But anyway, this same deal seems to reflect that Israel was unfaithful to God, who symbolically is her husband. You know, the New Testament, Jesus is called the bridegroom, and the church is called the bride. It's that relationship of husband-wife being an interpersonal relationship that the Bible picks up on for God. So the sons of Israel drank it, and we don't know what the implication were as far as judgment, but I'm sure they thought about it. In verse 21 it says, and Moses said to Aaron, what did this people do to you? Now, the rabbis, again, following their presupposition that Aaron was trapped in this, this is a word of sympathy on Moses' part, saying, oh, my brother, what could they have possibly done so bad to you that you had to respond in the way you did? But really, I think it's Moses putting a bite on his brother, not sympathy. Now, notice what Aaron says in verse 22. It's not my fault. It's their fault. They're prone to evil. Boy, this is another pass the buck deal, just like Eve and Adam and all the rest of them in the garden. Aaron says, well, it's not my fault. They did it. Trying to pass the blame. Notice verse 24. This is something that really seems ludicrous to us. And I said to them, whoever has any gold, let them tear it off. And so they gave it to me, and I threw it in the fire, and out came this calf. Seems like Aaron's saying it was just a miracle. I threw this stuff in there, and out popped the calf. Now, that seems ridiculous to us, because it says earlier it was a molten calf, that the engraving tool. Aaron did it himself. But the rabbis, again, say that what happened here, these magicians who were part of the mixed multitude that came out of Egypt, they're the ones that performed their magical powers, and this calf did come out of the fire. Matter of fact, they go back to Psalms 106, verses 19 and 20, and say, this calf, this golden calf, actually came alive and began to eat grass like a normal calf. And Aaron saw it was the work of Satan, but didn't know how to stop it. Now, that's the interpretation of the rabbis based on Psalms 106, verse 20. To me, it just seems, again, like he's trying to, say, well, it wasn't me. Now, look at verse 25. Now, when Moses saw the people were out of control, which seems to, there's 1.5 million people, he couldn't stop it. They were having these fertility rituals all over the camp. Look what he did. Moses stood at the gate of the camp and said, whoever is for the Lord, come to me. And all the sons of Levi gathered themselves to him. Now, the Levi is, of course, Moses' tribe. This seems to be a theological background to them becoming priests, because they're going to go through the camp and kill 3,000 of their fellow brothers. And it shows that their priority commitment is to God even before family. And so this seems to set the stage for them becoming the priestly tribe. Well, they killed 3,000 men, verse 28. The last part of verse 27, my translation says, every man his neighbor, but in reality it means every man his kin. Now, this reminds me of Matthew 10, 34 through 39, that if you love father or mother more than me, you're not worthy of me. And that's exactly what these Levites had to face. Here they were going to have to avenge their own blood relationships. Now, 3,000 people doesn't sound like many when compared to 1.5 million people. So maybe this was just the ringleaders, or maybe it was those who were still involved in the camp in these fertility rites, which it is. We're just not certain. Notice in verse, 29, it says, dedicate yourselves today to the Lord. That word means ordain yourself, fill your hands, a way of commitment which seems to set the stage for them becoming priests later on. Verse 30. Now, it came about the next day that Moses said to the people, you yourselves, now this is emphatic in the Hebrew, you yourselves have committed a great sin, and now I'm going to the Lord, perhaps I can make atonement. The word perhaps speaks of doubt and faith all mixed together. I think all of God's people have been a unique mixture of doubt and faith. If you look at Exodus chapter 3, the call of Moses, you know it's a mixture of doubt and faith. If you look at Moses when he gets so frustrated at the people, it's a mixture of doubt and faith. If you see that Moses, the great leader and lawgiver, can't enter the promised land because of his open-eyed rebellion against the obvious word of God, you see that all of us are a mixture of doubt and faith. Now, the word atonement is from the word kippur, or covering. We get the word Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur, from that. So that's what the word is here. Now, and Moses returned to the Lord and said, alas, the implication is he went back up on the mountain. Alas, this people has committed a great sin. They have made a god of gold, that's the word Elohim again, for themselves. That seems it's supposed to represent Yahweh. But now if thou wilt forgive their sin, and if not, please blot me out of the book which thou hast written. Now this seems to be a reference to the concept in the Bible of the book of life. It's that God has people's names. Now the archaeological background seems to be that ancient cities kept a register of their citizens. And that seemed through time to be transferred, that God kept a register of the people who were truly His. I guess in our day we'd have to give God a computer, but I think it's a metaphor. I think God has a good enough memory to remember. But there are two different books in the Bible. From Revelation chapter 20, verse 12, it says the books, plural, were opened. Now, I think one is the book of life, and the other is the book of remembrances. One is the book of believers. The other is the record of the acts of the unbelievers. Let me give you some scriptures that seem to delineate those particular two books. For the book of life, you might want to see Psalm 69:28. Luke 10:20 and Revelation 21:27. For the book of remembrances, you might want to see Psalms 56:8, Psalms 139:16, Isaiah 65:6, and Malachi 3:16. I hope you'll look those up. You may differ with which one they're in, but they're still a reference to this idea of the book that our names are recorded in. Now, notice where it mentions here, blot me out. You see it in verse 23 and in verse, 32 and 33. Ancient ink was an ink that included acid, and it burnt itself into the kind of writing materials they had. Now, if that's true, or if all Moses had was rock, it's hard to somehow erase your name in rock. Or if it's in ink on some kind of writing material, the acid would burn. So it seems to be almost impossible to blot it out, but there's where God's miraculous nature comes in. Now it says, whoever has sinned against me, I will blot him out of my book, God says. Now this idea of individual responsibility seems so common and everyday to us, but it was a unique concept in the life of Moses and in the nation of Israel. The most influential concept in the Old Testament is the concept of corporality, which we have almost lost completely in our day. We've gone to the other extreme. And it was seen as the nation of Israel, the tribe, you know. And I think this individual aspect is very important to give a balance. You might want to see Ezekiel 18, 1 through 32, Ezekiel 33, 10 through 20, and also the book of Jeremiah 31, 29 and 30. Now, in our day, we've made just the opposite mistake. I think we forget that we as Christians, individual responding believers, have a responsibility to our collective society. We are going to bear the sins that our society reaps. And therefore, we better be cognizant of what they're doing and try to permeate that with the salt of our own belief, lest we reap the whirlwind of the unbelievers around us. And so there's a corporate aspect to our faith today. Now, notice in verse 34. But go now, lead the people where I told you. Behold, my angel shall go before you. Nevertheless, in the day when I punish, I will punish them for their sin. You might want to see chapter 33:3. Now, of course, God's angel many times is the angel of the Lord, which really is a personification of himself. But it seems to always make a distinction between God and the angel. God is never identified with the angel as God is never identified with the death angel that passed through Egypt. God is never identified with his spirit. There's always a separation there. Now, in chapter 33, which is really the consequences of the golden calf, we see that angel mentioned again. When it says, I will punish them for their sins, now God's going to forgive them, okay? He's going to restore them to his people. But notice they pay for the consequence of their sin. Friends, sin always runs its course. God will certainly forgive us, but we always carry the scars in our own life, in our own nation, in our own society for the sins of ourselves and our fellow man. And I think we need to realize that sin always runs its course. God forgives, but the consequences affect our daily life from then on. Then in verse 35, then the Lord smote the people because of what they did with the calf which Aaron had made. Maybe, I don't know exactly what that's referring to. Maybe it was the dying in the wilderness, that generation, you know, dying there. I really don't know what that last verse means, but the consequences were carried over. The book of Exodus is a very interesting study. I think the writing of Moses really sets the stage for us understanding the rest of the Bible. As far as the Jews were concerned, the first five books of the Bible were the most authoritative books. And matter of fact, in Jesus' day, the Sadducees only accepted the law of Moses. The Pharisees accepted the whole Old Testament as authoritative. But even when Jesus wanted to really lock down, or Paul wanted to really lock down a point, they would go back to the Pentateuch to quote a verse there. So this is what's officially known as the Torah, or the law. And so it is a very very important aspect of the Jewish mind is these first five books, Genesis through Deuteronomy. Well, I've enjoyed being with you. I hope you'll send for our free catalog, where I've done many other studies in the Pentateuch, especially in Exodus. And I think this overview of the Old Testament will really help you understand the New Testament better. So many Christians neglect the study of the Old Testament. But I want to say to you that you can't fully understand the New Testament till you understand the Old Testament. Everything in the New Testament is in incipient form in the Old Testament, and is a real foundation for us to see. So I hope you'll send for that catalog and look at the other studies that are available in the Old Testament. I've enjoyed so much being with you. I hope to see you next week, same time, same place. God bless you.